Peter Cipollone. I'm the co-founder and CEO of InstaAdvisor.com, which is an online mentorship network platform. I'm also an Olympic gold medalist in the sport of rowing, which I started out in when I was, like, I think 13 years old. So the way that that all began was that as a little kid, I was fat. And my dad said to me, you know, you're going to be bald, you're short, you can't be fat. So you got to do something. You got to find a sport that you like. And I had tried like baseball and stuff like that, and it wasn't really my cup of tea. And he said, look, this summer I am going to be coaching the 17 and 18 year olds down at the Boathouse. This was in Philadelphia on Boathouse Row. And he's like, you can come down, give it a try, see if you like it. And if you do, you'll be with the sort of younger kids program. And so I went down and I liked it. I became a coxswain. Even then I was small. So now I'm 5'1". Then I was probably about 4'3 or something. You know, ridiculously small. And so I got in the back of the boat and I was steering and yelling at the guys. And I had no idea what I was doing, but I loved it. And they said, like, hey, it's great. You know, we think you're doing a really good job, especially for a novice, but we're not going to lug your fat butt around. So you got to lose some weight. You know, you got to get in shape. So I started going for a run every night after practice. And pretty soon I lost a bunch of weight. And it was great. It was really cool. So that was how I got started. And then that same summer, my dad took me to watch the Olympics in Los Angeles. And we saw some really cool stuff. So saw Carl Lewis win the 200-meter dash, which was neato. So that was in the LA Coliseum. Saw Evander Holyfield get disqualified, which I had no idea. But one thing I'll never forget about that was that the fans from Puerto Rico were like sitting right next to us. And I've never seen such a, like, an exuberant bunch of people. I mean, they were just waving flags and cheering and like blowing whistles and all the stuff you imagine. That was pretty cool. So that, you know, and of course, obviously we also saw rowing. And that really got me excited about the Olympics. And I thought, like, wow, I wonder if I could do that. And especially seeing some rowers win a gold medal, which hadn't happened in a while. So that was like a super big deal, you know, for the rowing community in the United States. But I went on to high school to be a coxswain. And while I was in high school, my dad said, you know, you're getting really into this rowing thing. Maybe you should try something else and just make sure. And I was like, okay. So I wrestled. And I only wrestled for one season, but I was pretty good at it. I had a winning record, which apparently was unusual. But I really enjoyed it. But it was like, okay, I kind of have to choose, you know, I got to pick one because the seasons overlapped a little bit. I'll never forget. Sophomore spring, my rowing coaches, like, I was in the doghouse for a while because I showed up like 2 weeks late for the start of the season. And so I did it through high school, then went on to Berkeley, where I studied economics, among other things. I studied a bunch of stuff and then kind of finally settled on econ. And I also was a coxswain. And we weren't very good in college. And that was really tough, actually. But I learned a lot from that experience of getting my butt kicked every week and every year, basically. Like in rowing, you give your shirt away when you lose, and I think I graduated without any shirts. Like I still don't have a jersey from my college days. But along the way, I knew that I wanted to at least try to make the Olympic team, or, you know, just see how far I could take it. And that, you know, the ultimate goal is to win a gold medal in the Olympics. And that I had gotten that goal pretty early. Like, I started thinking about that, like, right after the Olympics with it, we went to watch, and it just sort of started to snowball. And so let's see, the summer after high school, I made the junior national team after getting cut the year before. So, you know, my first experience there was pretty rough. And then into college, the summer after my sophomore year, I very unexpectedly made the Pan American Games team going to Havana. And this is worth pausing for a second, because my first 2 years of college were really rough. I was a very good student in high school, and I liked school. I'm a nerd. And I couldn't get a handle on Berkeley. I was just not engaging the school in the way that I needed to be successful. I wasn't necessarily going to class all the time. And as a result, I was getting C's. And so I was supremely, I mean, straight up, I was depressed. Like, I was going, you know, circling the drain. And, you know, I got a message from my dad saying, hey, like, you know, I don't pay for C's, and I don't think you went to college to get C's. Why don't you take a year off and figure out what you want to do with your life. And is this, you know, are you just wasting your time? And I went home and, you know, kind of when I got home, I slept for like 5 days. I was just like, oh, you know, finally, like I'm in a safe place and it was cool. But then I made the Pan Am team and I wasn't expecting that. And I made it in like the bottom boat, you know, like we were the worst crew. I think we're the only crew on the U.S. team that didn't get a medal, which kind of sucked, but certainly added some fire. I went back to college after a year away and seeing, okay, it's really hard to get a job without a degree. And, you know, I can't do any of the things that excite me because nobody will hire me. And I had a renewed sense of purpose with that. And I knew that from my sports experience, I kind of knew it's like, okay, what do you learn from a sport like rowing? Well, you learn to make a race plan. And so I made myself a little race plan and I got a job. I changed majors from, I had been studying computer science, I switched to economics and I loved it. Like I was so excited about the subject material that it was easy to get into it. And I also just had always in the back of my head, like, hey, if you screw this up, like you're not gonna be able to get a job. So stay focused. And I did that and I did really well in economics. It was just, it clicked for me. And then graduation time came and, you know, I went through some of the recruiting processes and did some preliminary interviews. You know, economics majors typically go to like investment banks and stuff. So I was like, I'm going to go in and just do this, even though I know what I'm doing after I graduate. I'm going for the Olympics. Like, I'm not going to get a job. I'm not going to do that. So I went in, kind of had some fun with those. And then as soon as I graduated, straight to the national team, where I was essentially the number two coxswain. And the problem with that is that in the Olympics, there's only one. So I had to beat out the incumbent who had just, my first summer out of college, had won the world championship, set the world record. It was just like, ooh, that's going to be hard. And coxswains are, you generally don't replace them midstream. So it was doubly hard. But the next year, 1995, we won the world championship in our event, which was the four. The four is still not an Olympic event. So that was a good jumping off point. At least I could say, hey, I'm a world champion too. Yeah, the event's not as competitive, but whatever. And 1996, this was it. Like I wanted to make the Olympics, get a medal, get out. And what I wanted to do back then was actually go get my PhD and become a professor of econometrics. So like statistics, basically super duper nerdy. And that didn't happen, but what I learned from that experience, like I went in and I gave it everything I had. I just said, I'm going to do my absolute best and let the chips fall where they may. And there were some times where I got really nervous during the selection of coxswains part of the year. And that affected my performance negatively. I made some mistakes, like some dumb mistakes that you shouldn't make. But I recovered. And then in the very final selection, it was live. So the coach said, well, we have this race against Canada. Pete, you're going to be the coxswain. We'll see how it goes. And I had the race of my life. Like to that date, I had the best performance I'd ever had. And I went to the guys afterwards and I said, listen, like I made some mistakes earlier, but I want you to know that like what you just saw was my very best. So whatever you choose to do, like it's, you know, it's out of my hands. Like I have done everything I can. And I like, my head is high regardless. And so they picked the other guy. And that was it was a tough one. Again, it was going to be hard to unseat him. But I learned so much in my life from losing. Like winning doesn't teach you a whole lot. It's really fun and it's what you try to do, but it's when you don't meet your own expectations, or even sometimes when you do meet your own expectations and you still lose, then you really have to go back and reflect on what can I do better next time? Like what was not perfect and how can I get it as close to perfect as possible? And then the team went on, they didn't get a medal in the Olympics, which was, you have kind of mixed emotions about that, but at the same time, like they're your friends and you want to see them be successful. And that was pretty rough. And I'm still pretty tight with a lot of the people who were in that crew. And they fired the coach, hired a new coach. And the new coach was the freshman coach at Princeton University. And he said, well, I live in Princeton, so I guess you guys are all moving to Princeton. So I packed up my junk and I moved from Chula Vista, California to Princeton, New Jersey. And the first practice, he sits us down and he says, you have 6 weeks to get a job. If you can't find a job in 6 weeks, then I will spend 6 weeks trying to find you a job. And if I can't find you a job, you can't train here. So it was mandatory to have a job. And I remember, you know, those first 2 years out of college were pretty lean. Like, I'd saved a ton of money from working, and I got graduation gifts and stuff like that that I basically lived off of, but it was tight. And all of a sudden, I had a few bucks in my pocket. So I got a job as an intern at Dow Jones, which is the publisher of the Wall Street Journal. They had a big online services division, and I had a good tech background. So I joined there as an intern, and you know, within like a week, they offered me a full-time job. And that was great. Like, I was rolling fat. You know, I was making like 35 grand a year. Like, yeah, dude. And so I said to the coach, like, what's up with that? And he said, listen, like, most of the guys here right now, 4 years before the next Olympics, are not going to make it all the way to the Olympics. Like, they're going to get injured. They're going to get cut. That something is going to happen that interrupts their Olympic dream. And if you have a job, you have something to go to if it all goes pear-shaped. But the other benefit of that is that people know they have something to go to, so they just let it all hang out when they row. They're just like, I'm just going to go nuts with this, and if it doesn't work out, I'm not going to be, you know, sleeping in a cardboard box or, you know, flipping burgers somewhere. So that was really, really valuable to me as a competitor or as, you know, aspiring Olympian to have something that I could, it was a diversion. And not only was it was a diversion that gave me a paycheck. So I could pay rent and live in like a decent place in my own bedroom. I had sheets, you know, and food and stuff like that. And it made life a lot easier, but you know, at the cost of, okay, you know, we're up at 6 a.m. for practice. You're at your desk at 9. You're back home from practice at 8:30 at night. It basically, your day is, you know, you got a 15-hour day every day, and you live like a monk. But it's a, you know, I mean, if you got to be a monk, like, this is the way to do it. So that was really helpful. And along the way, while we were training, I started to rise up a little bit at Dow Jones, and then they merged their division with a division from Reuters and made a company called Factiva, which I was one of the original employees of. And that was really fun. Like, it was a totally just different experience away from rowing. And when I had a really bad practice, I could go to work and like throw myself into work and just beat myself to death. And then come up like 5 o'clock, I'd be like, oh man, it's time for practice. Like, I'm glad because I'm really tired of doing this shit. And so then I'd go back. And it was like the lack of balance on both sides, you know, made it so that in the end, it all added up to balance. And that was huge. Now, during that Olympic cycle, so this was the Sydney Olympic cycle 2000, in 1997 at the World Championships, which is like the off-year equivalent of the Olympics, we won in the eight, which is a big deal. You know, our coach used to say, if you win the eight, you win the regatta. And it's kind of true. We weren't expecting to win. We had one athlete who had ever been in the eight before. So there were eight of us who had not. And here we are, like, we barely made the final. We're in the outside lane, and nobody was expecting anything from us, to the point where the crew that came in second, a couple of guys put their arms up, like, as if they had won. And then they looked over and went, where did they come from? So we got lucky and we won. The next year, we knew we were good enough to win, and all of a sudden, like, a bunch of guys from 96 came back, and we were really good. We had a crappy race in the final, and we killed everybody. So it was like a minute and a half in, we were in, like, sixth place, and then, like, 2.5 minutes in, we were winning by, like, 3 seconds. Like, we just blew by everybody. And then in 99, same thing, just a dominant win. Somebody passed us. And then we pass them again. And in rowing, the eight is like the 100-meter dash. You don't, if you get passed, you're not coming back. But we did it. So just ultra dominance. And, you know, the big buzz in rowing at that time was like, can anyone do anything about the Americans in the eight? Because they're going to crush everybody next year. We get to Sydney, and through some, you know, pretty serious mistakes that, you know, I mean, obviously, the coach is ultimately responsible, but I think the people who were sort of senior leaders on the team, like myself, have to take some blame for what happened. But we changed some personnel, and we came in fifth in the Olympics, and that was the most devastating thing that had ever happened to me. It was worse to make it and do poorly than it was to not make it, and that was brutal. So for a whole year, I took the next year off, and I didn't even know if I was going to go back. I was just like, I, It was the first thing that I thought about when I woke up in the morning, and it was the last thing I thought about before I went to bed. It just dominated my life. But I went back to work, just like our coach said, you know, if everything goes pear-shaped, you got something to go back to. So I threw myself into work for a year and just worked my brains out. And that was my, you know, sort of tonic. That was my way of keeping it up in my mind. And in 2002, the coach called me and said, hey, if you come back, I'll put you in the eight. So I wasted no time. I said that I'll call you back. You know, he's like, let me know next week. And this was in like June. The World Championships are in August. I'm thinking like, this is like the deal of the century. So I took it, and I was going into a crew that had won a World Cup race, which is like a sort of an early season, you know, like preliminary test. And I got in there. I was the only change, and they went from winning the World Cup to coming in third at the World Championships. But, you know, I think they were a little bummed. My teammates were a little bit bummed on the medal stand, but I'm thinking, I was comparing it to Sydney, you know, and it's like, oh, okay, we got a bronze medal. Like, we got a medal. This is fantastic. And so, you know, I learned a little bit more about coxing in that year, which was, it's important. You got to be around, you know, you have to be engaged with the team through most, if not all, of the season, because I think it did cost us a little bit in the final. I mean, maybe we would have gotten a silver medal, you know, but I don't know that we would have won. The team that won was much better than we were. And then, you know, fast forward, like the next year, we get a silver medal at the World Championship. So at least the trajectory looks good. But there was no pressure going into 2004 for us to medal, because there wasn't a huge expectation. I mean, I think after 2000, everyone had gotten so excited in the rowing community. You know, it's been 36 years since we've won a gold medal in the eight. You know, this is the one. And then, of course, we blew it. In 2004, everybody was just too emotionally tired. It's like, yeah, you know, whatever. Yeah, these guys, nice guys in the eight. Yeah, real nice guys. And but we had a good season leading up to it, and we had one of my best friends came back out of retirement, a guy named Chris Ahrens, and he was really good. And then some of our under 23s like came of age in like October of 2003, and all of a sudden we had this talented pool, and we got into the meat of the season. So, you know, sort of March was really when people were going to start being selected and being cut. And the coach narrowed it down to 12 people and separated us from everybody else. And it was all business then. Like at that point, we didn't have time to work. So I was on a leave of absence from my job, or just like going to the office an hour a day or something, and just be like, hey, what's up? And so that was tougher because you didn't have that balance. And it was really intense, because all of a sudden we could feel like, you know what, we're pretty fast. And not only are we pretty fast, we're consistently fast. And so all of this starts to get into your head like, okay, well, maybe we could do well. And, you know, fast forward to, I guess, the couple months before the Olympics, something that I realized that I think is important in every athlete's career is that I knew this was it. I was never going to do this again. And all of a sudden, I was like in my last, you know, whether it was 12 weeks or 10 weeks or whatever, I said, you know, I really should be enjoying practice. Like I should be kind of taking it in a little bit, where it's like, I hated the practice. Like I loved, you know, I love to race and I love to rehearse racing, but going out and rowing around for 2 hours and freezing and working on people's technique for 2 hours, that wasn't my, I mean, I did it because you had to do it to be good, but that wasn't the thing that I liked. And when I realized that like what I was telling myself was like, be present in the moment and kind of take all of this in, because it's going to end soon. And I actually think I got a lot better in like the last 12 weeks of my career, because I was just really absorbed in what's going on right now. What am I doing with my hands right now? Am I steering the boat perfectly straight? All these little final bits where I was like, I was stuck at being very good. And then all of a sudden I was like, okay, now like maybe this is as good as I can be. Like I'm all of a sudden, maybe I'm as close to the best that I can do. And that, I think for all athletes, if there's a moment in your career when you can achieve that, especially earlier on, to say, hey, I'm going to enjoy the process. Like it doesn't have to be fun every day, but like, I love being here. And this, you know, I say now, like I got to spend my youth with basically hanging out with my buddies for 4 or 5 hours a day outside in the sun. Like that's a good deal. And, you know, regardless of all the, you know, sort of gnarly stuff that happened during those 4 or 5 hours, like in broad strokes, that's a lot of people would love to have that opportunity. And so appreciating that and really being present there and understanding, like, okay, enjoy the process, made me better at a time when I didn't really think I would be getting better. And then, you know, you fast forward just to those last couple weeks before the competition. And this is when, you know, you've already made the Olympic team. The craziness is on, because even though we weren't very heralded, it was still, you know, somebody from the New York Times wants to talk to you, or your hometown newspaper wants to interview you, and your parents need tickets and like all this crazy stuff. And you just kind of have to say, hey, like, I'm focused on this. Like, I have 8 teammates who are counting on me, and this is what I'm focused on right now. I'd really love to talk to you, and I'd love to get my name in print and all that stuff. Like, that's really fun, but it'd be a whole lot more fun to do it afterwards, especially with a medal around our necks. So having gone through sort of the meltdown of Sydney, and, you know, like in Sydney, we were on the Today Show before the Olympics and all kinds of cool stuff. The veterans of the Sydney crew, and there were 3 of us, said, like, hey, let's just push all these distractions to the side. And, you know, one guy even said, it's like, hey, your parents have bought tickets to sporting events before. They don't need your help. So, you know, just tell people, if your parents say, hey, what do we do about tickets? And say, hey, you know, use the internet, do whatever you normally do. And we were good at keeping all that stuff sort of at bay. And what that did was it brought us closer as a team. And we realized that we were very united in our goal of just going as fast as we possibly could. We weren't thinking about medals. I mean, in the back of your head, you realize, like, you go out on the race course and you do some time that is like 2 seconds under the world record, and you're thinking, like, maybe there's a gold medal in here somewhere. You kind of got to put that out of your mind. I mean, unless you've gone out and won, you know, if this is your 4th Olympics and you're a 3-time gold medalist or whatever, you know what you're doing. But if you're going in your first time, you know, forget about the ordinal rank. Like, don't worry about 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 5th. Just aim yourself at being ready to have the best performance you've ever had. And even if that's just a little tiny bit better than the one before it, that's fine. Like, you just want to be your best on race day. And we were really, like, as the racing went on, so in the heat, we drew the number 1 seed, it was Canada. And we were a little bit miffed about that because we felt we should have been the number 2 seed, but we weren't. We raced them, and it was an amazing tailwind. And in rowing, you need a tailwind to break the world record. And we broke the world record by a lot. We broke it by 3 seconds, which we didn't realize until we were rowing back to the dock, and some dude from NBC is like waving. He's like, no, come over here. We want to interview you. So we stopped off on the media dock, and the guy's like, did you know you just broke the world record? And I guys threw their arms up so fast, I think, like, he almost got, like, punched in the face. And so guys, like, whoa. But then we had a whole week between then and our final to just prepare ourselves. And we stayed away from the drama. You know, like, we didn't even go to the opening ceremonies. We just kind of hung out. We brought lots and lots of things to keep ourselves busy and just little distractions. You know, you get a nice nap in during the day, that kind of stuff, get some food. We would go out for rows at weird times, so there would only be a couple of crews out on the lake. And just, I think at this point, I had never said anything to anyone about being present in the moment and taking it all in, but everybody had kind of figured that out in their own way, and they were doing that. They were present in the moment and enjoying the process and not stressing about, like, hey, we went really fast in the heat, I hope we can do it again in the final, or anything like that. It was just like, no, like, we're here, it's now, the Olympics are on, this is the stuff that we got, this is what we're going to race with, and let's just make sure that we do that, and not, you know, we're not going to try something strange, we're not going to invert our race plan or do something stupid, just because, hey, it might work. Don't go with what might work, like, go with what does work. And then in the final, we had, I guess, you know, the dream, the goal that I had sort of set when I was young, it all came together, and we had the performance of our lives. Like, that was as fast as we could go that day, up until about 10 strokes to go, when we didn't need to go fast anymore. We were that far ahead. And the stroke man, the guy that sits in front of me, I was talking to him actually just a couple weeks ago about this, and, you know, we reminisce, of course. And he was like, yeah, 10 strokes to go. I tried to go. And I could just feel like the crew didn't want to do it. He was like, okay, this is it. And so we won the gold medal in the Olympics. And there, chapter, you know, sort of closes. And great fun for the rest of the year. That was amazing. I got to do all kinds of cool stuff. But the lessons in all of that, you know, were that translate out into the real world are so many. You know, one, as an athlete, you have an incredible set of advantages going into the workforce. So you're disciplined. You understand what a training program is, which maps to, okay, here's what we got to get done this quarter or this month or this week. You know what that means, and you know how to prioritize things and say, okay, if I need to get Z done, I got to get, you know, A through Y done first. I guess I'll just start at A and start knocking things off. And you become very efficient in, like, the stuff you have to do, and you're pretty smart about prioritizing, and athletes have good instincts for what's working, what's not working. Like, those things pay off when you get into the real world. The thing that I found that isn't like sports out in the business world is that in sports, your teammates all have the same goal, right? Whether you're competing together or you're competing against each other, everybody wants to get across the line first, or, you know, do that perfect 10 score or whatever it is. Like, it's all the same goals, and it's very simple. It's extremely easy to understand. It's just really hard to do. In the business world, your teammates will have all kinds of different goals and different motivations. So one person wants to move up the chain, and that might mean stepping on your back. Another person just has three kids and likes spending a lot of time with their kids. So basically, they're going to do the minimum that they have to do to keep their job, and then, you know, then they're off doing whatever is most important to them. And the other big thing is that the business world does not have those neat sort of finish lines. And you have to create them. Like, bend the world to something you understand. Create finish lines, recruit teammates, get people to help you. Don't try to do it all by yourself. And that's the satisfaction. Like, in the end, one of the great things about rowing, at least, you know, in an eight, is that it's a team sport. And there's so many people on the team that no individual is going to get any glory. It's all about the team. And so the satisfaction really comes from achieving the goal, not from, like, I made the cover of the Wheaties box. Like, that's awesome. Or, you know, you're not going to get rich doing as an Olympian. I mean, a few people will, but most won't. And that's not why we do it. But so you learn that satisfaction of achieving the goal, right? You become goal-oriented. Like, if you made it this far as an athlete, you are, by definition, goal-oriented. And I think that, you know, the last thing that really makes a difference for athletes is, like, the one skill that matters more than any of the others is that the reason why you've made it this far is that at every opportunity you had to walk away with your head held kind of high, or, you know, just walk out with dignity, you didn't quit. And a lot of times, like, the race goes to the person who doesn't quit. And I think in the wider world, we're often surprised by how easily other people throw in the towel. And that's a big skill that carries over from elite athletics into business life. And, you know, when I say business life, whether you go into education or nonprofit or whatever, you know, whatever it is you're doing, whatever your real life becomes, like, all of those skills just totally pay off. And you just have to kind of find ways, or I should say you have to, this is what's worked for me, right? Find ways to bend the world into a form that looks like something you recognize and know how to deal with, right? Which is finish lines, you know, get the team lined up and execute the race plan. Like, that kind of mentality really has paid off, at least in my case.
Yeah.
Okay. So just for some examples, we can sort of take the playbook that I just talked about, and, you know, I'll give you some real world examples of how I apply those things in business. So one example is that when I was at Factiva, I was made responsible for identifying technologies that we had as a company that were potentially patentable. Now, I worked in the technology group, but there were, you know, 15 different teams, all of which had their own systems to work on, but they also had, like, their own day-to-day problems. And so what I did was, you know, I thought about it. I said, okay, what's the finish line here? Well, we need a bunch of patents, right? We need to find things that are patentable and then start executing that process. So I grabbed the attorneys and said, hey, I've been tasked with this. Can you, you know, get educated and line up a team of people so that when I find stuff to evaluate, we can get right on it? And so the attorneys were great. Like, they knew this was coming, and so they jumped right on. They didn't need, you know, they didn't need motivation per se. They knew what that finish line was, and they were right there. Going to the other technology teams was a different story. So they, as anyone who's worked with software knows, like, it never works the way you want it to. There's always a bug, and you're like, no, no, that's supposed to work. And you're like, well, it doesn't. So they have their own day-to-day problems. But what I needed from every one of these teams was basically a detailed presentation on what their technology did and exactly how it worked at a step-by-step level. And, you know, I had to sell them on it. I had to say, look, this is, you know, this is our goal as a team, is to see if there's anything that your team has in there that we can patent. And by the way, here's the incentive. You're going to get your name on a U.S. patent if it's granted. There is a, you know, a small sort of stipend that goes with, if your patent is approved, you get, you know, $1,000 or something. I mean, it wasn't, for a lot of these people, it wasn't necessarily enough money to be like, oh, I'm going to drop everything I'm doing to do this, but it, at least it was something. And I started with that, and I let everybody know this is what we're doing. And I said, you know, I'd like to just do these. We have to do sort of in order. But, you know, do we have any volunteers? Anybody, like, excited about this? And couple of groups that I had sort of warmed up ahead of time were like, yeah, yeah, like, we want to do this. We're excited because we think we actually have some stuff. And so then everybody else was like, oh, well, okay, yeah, we want to get in line too. And so getting people motivated to, you know, show them, hey, there's something valuable in this for you, but here's our finish line. This is, once we get across this, like, I'll be out of your hair. And so in the process of that, we identified, I think, three different technologies that we had that were patentable. And then as I got to know and understand patents better, so as I, you know, sort of, I improved in my skills, I recognized two things that I had worked on and sort of, I guess, designed and created that were also patentable. So I ended up with two patents out of it on my own. But just getting people aligned toward that finish line, make sure they understand this is the goal that we're trying to accomplish. And that was, it was something like, that's an easy one, because once that exercise is done, it's done. There's a real finish line. But then later in my career at Factiva, I got this huge promotion after the Olympics, and I was put in charge of basically a startup division of the company that was about to land on its butt. So they had sold a bunch of software into big customers for big money, and they had a partnership with IBM to work on the software, and all of a sudden the software wasn't working as advertised. And we recognized it, and IBM recognized it. And we said, okay, we're going to part ways amicably, but we were the ones that had all the customers and the sales reps who were looking for commissions and you know, customers who wanted the software. So I was put in charge of this, a team of about 20 people. And the CEO called me like a week later and said, hey, I found this neat company in London that I think we need to acquire. And it's a little bit of a spin on what your team is doing and what our customers have been promised, but this is a way to keep things moving forward. So we went through it, and, you know, I flew over to London, and we did the acquisition, and all of a sudden I had like 20 more people sort of in my reporting structure. And the founders of the other company were very much not aligned. They did not like the idea. You know, the guy that was the CEO now kind of reported to me. He didn't like that. And so, and that's it's normal human behavior, right? There's nothing wrong with that. It's just the way it is. And he had his own motivations. And I, for the first time, I had to sit there and think, okay, this person's motivation is not so simple as let's grow this business, let's grow the revenue, let's have lots and lots of really happy customers. It's like, this person also wants to be recognized as one of the driving forces behind this and the visionary that made this all happen, because when big giant Dow Jones and Reuters couldn't make it happen, they bought his company. And so taking a moment to step back and say, okay, this is more complex than just a finish line. As a matter of fact, there is no finish line here. Like, when this month is done, we got new numbers for next month, and it just keeps on going and going and going like that. So you have to make these sort of short steps along the way. And, you know, one of the steps that I made in that one was, let's find a way to take this founder and put him out there in the world. Let him be the face of the product as opposed to me doing that. So, you know, I stepped back and he was the public face. And then, you know, my job, I said, look, what I'll do is I'll go out with the sales teams. And when a sales team has something on the 1 yard line, I'll come in as like the closer, you know. And so it was finding a way to basically create, you know, we created a goal, which was to help this person be the face. He knew he'd be good at it, and that would give him the recognition that he wanted. And we put him there, and he did it, and he did a fantastic job. And then, you know, I went and found something else that was really important, but that wasn't sort of sexy or glamorous or anything like that, but it helped accomplish the goal. And so that's a relatively soft example of, you know, finding out people's motivations, because it's that's an easy one. Like, it wasn't like his motivation was to climb up in the organization over the backs of so many people. And you'll run into that today. Like, we were fortunate not to have that, but this was just a case of where person, like, he poured his heart and soul into this company and it got acquired, and he didn't just want to be a cog in the machine. And so, you know, just applying that playbook worked. And that was hard. Like, I learned that, that was where I learned that, like, real and hard. And so, you know, now with Instavisor, so it's a startup. So, you know, every day is an adventure, and it's the same, it's the same thing, but it's just, everything's much smaller. It's like, today, if we can get 3 bugs fixed today, like, that's a good day. Or if we can actually complete 3 sales calls, that's an achievement, right? It's almost like, think about it. When you're an Olympic level athlete, the comparison to a startup is like when you're coming off an injury or you're coming out of a slump. It's like baby steps every day. Like, get your butt out of bed, get something done. Just get something done. And then it starts to snowball. Like, your pace starts to accelerate, and you go through this period of, you know, when you're starting a company, the very beginning, you know, especially if it's a tech company and software based, it's like, what do you have? You have an idea, you have a vision, and nobody wants to talk to you because you don't have a product. There's nothing they can see and feel. And, you know, nobody wants to talk to you just because it's like, oh, you're just going to fail, whatever. But you, coming back from an injury, you're coming out of a slump, just the little basic things, like, just, they say it, you know, they say it, but it's true. It's just like 1 foot in front of the other, just a little bit. And then all of a sudden, pretty soon, like, you're like, all right, I got my rhythm back. Now I got my pace. And, like, your teammates, like, in a startup, you can't do it without, like, really good teammates. And so that's like, one of the key things. And all of a sudden, when you feel like you're aligned and you're going toward that same finish line almost without even having talked about it a lot, like, that's when you start getting up to your Olympic speed or your top speed. Like, okay, now we're starting to groove. And that is... Those are the lessons from sport that I apply today. And sometimes, you know, if you have a bad day or a bad week and you get really beat up, it's like, okay, rule number one is, you know, take off the covers, both feet on the floor, and get your day started and get one thing done. Just get one thing done and then see how you feel. And that was, you know, whether it was after Sydney or, you know, just after not making the 8 in 1996, you know, those are you think back to what did I do then, and you apply that when you're starting a company. And that's what I've learned. And that's what we're doing here.